Welcome to the Godel Pod, where we speak to Nick Hodder, Assistant Director of the Imperial War Museum, with a particular focus on leading by example. Nick, if you don't mind, first and foremost, could you just introduce yourself to those that are listening?
Sure. So I'm Nick Hodder. I'm the Assistant Director of Digital Transformation at the Imperial War Museums. That means I'm in charge of, it sounds like I make cups of tea for the actual Director of Digital Transformation, but I'm actually in charge of it. So there you go.
You're not an assistant to the director, like the office kind of joke.
Sometimes I get phone calls which the reaction is kind of, could you put me through to the actual director? But that is technically me.
Perfect. No, good to hear. And I also hear you're I suppose part-time stand-up comic or do some of that in your free time as well. I found your website, nickhodder.com, as a little plug there as well. And I've seen, did you perform the Edinburgh Fringe, if I'm not mistaken?
Yeah, I've performed at many Edinburgh Fringes going back, well over a decade. Yeah, but in order to set expectations for this particular podcast, I'll try to remain in the professional capacity. But yeah, I can occasionally pull out the odd gag here and there. But yeah, I don't set the expectation too high. It's mainly going to be about digital and people. Yeah,
no. Absolutely, categorically, let's not be funny on this podcast. But no, I heard you talk probably 2 or 3 months ago at an event focused on leading by example. And I think you covered 3 points and used some quite nice analogies. I think it was the HMS Belfast you used as an analogy, sailing through a storm. But focusing on, I think, how to empower your team, how to balance conflicting interests, and I suppose the best ways to communicate and maximise engagement. And I suppose not to make you painfully take us through the analogy again, because I believe at that time you had a presentation which would give a lot more light to what I wanted to discuss. I suppose I wanted to take those points almost separately and talk through them. And I suppose separately talk through what challenges those might face, you know, from a high level into maybe deeper dive and challenges that might be caused off the back of them as well. So I suppose the first point was how to empower. And I think you articulated on the presentation that the main aim actually is to get out of the way and point people in the right destination ultimately. But could you expand on that a little bit for me and talk us through your methodology or ideas behind that?
Yeah, I guess when you say that, I think that if I try and put myself in the position of someone in an audience, I might be thinking, well, why? You know, what's the reason for that? And in my world, which is digital, but I think this has an effect in lots of areas of organizations as well. We're in this, actually, so a lot of the time now I start conversations by talking about the landscape, right? So we have businesses or charities or nonprofits, but essentially normally, even if we're B2B, B2B or B2C, ultimately there are customers at the end of that. And your customers are a product of the landscape that they're in. And the landscape is constantly changing. And sometimes we it's hard for us to notice that, okay, because we're in it. But when you think about 2007, doesn't feel like very far away for me. And the credit crunch and the financial crisis, et cetera, back in 2007. It feels like yesterday to me, but before that, we didn't have an iPhone. You think about like how much our worlds have changed through technology since that point, and it doesn't seem very long ago. Someone in my team the other day, someone told me that they were born in 2001, and for some reason, I couldn't get out of my head that they must be 12. But now, clearly, I'm not very good at maths, right? But our perception of time, it is somewhat warped, actually, just because we're in it and it's hard for us to tell. So our customers are in this landscape and we're in this landscape and it's changing really, really quickly. So the direct impact of that I see in my world is that there used to be digital generalists, people who knew all about digital. And very, very quickly, there's this exponential age, this unprecedented period of growth, where we require now all of these different specialisms. These specialisms are growing as much as the technology is, and they're becoming deeper. So as digital people become leaders, They might have deep knowledge in one area, but they'll be managing teams that have got a vast arrays of specialisms. And you can't teach them a skill you don't understand. Only they will know how to do their jobs. So you have to empower them to develop themselves. And essentially, in that kind of scenario, autonomy is your only option.
Yeah.
And I think that's the kind of, maybe digital is like the thing that is impacted first, but actually eventually I think that impacts kind of every role in an organization, every area of organizations. So really, I guess what I wanted to do is give some background as to, okay, so why would you want to do that? And for me, it's not just like a desire to do that. It's like, I don't really see that there's any other option.
Of course. I suppose, and I don't know if I'm paraphrasing too much, Nick, but it's the point you're trying to make here that they will always know how to do their subsection of their job better than you. So I suppose ultimately you should leave them to it. And I suppose within the remit of tech and digital as well, there's probably an extra layer to this where over time we advance and we innovate. So, you know, you as a leader may just get further and further away from being on the tools. So almost your knowledge base, even if you were an expert within a vertical previously, you're potentially almost going to become less of an expert if you're not on the tools, in my opinion, you know, over time as well, which is worrying.
I agree with that. And I think it's not just that you need to give them the space to become an expert in what they do, but you also actually, it's really important that you learn from them. You need to understand not the detail, but you need to understand what's affecting them, how that's moving, because that's how you support them. There's a really good book by a guy called David Marquette, who wrote a book called Turn This Ship Around, which is, so you and your audience may be familiar with it, but he's essentially a submarine captain who's put in charge of a submarine that he does not understand. You're supposed to train for a year to learn how to use a submarine, how to manage a submarine. And all submarines are different. So he's on this training course for a year where he's learning about the submarine that he's going to be the captain of. And then all of a sudden he's put in charge of a completely different submarine. And it's very similar to the scenario I've just described. You might have a depth of knowledge as a digital expert, but you go into a team and you don't understand how any of that works. So David Marquette uses pillars. So it isn't just kind of, okay, you just go ahead and do your job and I'm going to kick back and relax. And it would be lovely if that was the case, but it isn't. And so the pillars he refers to are control, competence, and clarity. So that as you as a leader needs to, that's what you need to be providing. That's your job. So you need to ensure that they're competent, and that means that they've got the adequate training, that they're supported. You need to ensure that they have controls, that they're empowered. So if you're asking them to do something, you need to ensure that they have the power to do that. And it actually, in a lot of time in blame cultures, that's not the case, which creates big problems. And then finally, and I think this is the most important thing, is clarity. It needs to be really clear where you're going, what the objective is, because you might be giving them power and control, and they might be competent, but if they don't know where they're going, then that is, for me, the biggest problem. And so that clarity, not just from you as a leader, but from the organization, is it clear what the organizational strategy is? Is it clear? Is it cascading down, from the leadership through the management of the organization, what we're trying to achieve and what the objectives are, what the goals are? And if it's not, it's your job as a leader to engage with the rest of the leadership to ensure that you have that clarity so you can pass it on to your team. So for me, it's not less work. It's way more work, in my experience. Yeah.
No, that's probably quite a nice segue almost onto point two of the talk that I heard you give. And it was around balancing conflicting interests. And I think what you said was conflicting interests often come from people focusing on short-term goals. My small box I operate within is the most important piece, but the larger term, I suppose, North Star, if you like, or vision as a business is actually what people should be looking at. And I think that's what you just sort of articulated there. But I suppose I was keen to understand almost how you would try and get people to transition from a short to a long-term goal, because you're almost changing people's mindsets, aren't you? From, you know, don't focus just on yourself, but what that bigger picture is. What's your thoughts or ideas on how to do that?
Yeah, so really good points. Okay, so for me, yeah, there's a lot of tension in those conflicting goals. And actually, and I'm guilty of this, and I think we all are, what you jump to is, why are they being so stupid, or why are they doing it like that, or they must be incompetent. And you come up with all these kind of reasons, often like personal reasons, as to why they're making your life so difficult. And the first thing to say is it almost certainly is, you know, it's not normally that person's fault. It's because of this lack of clarity, and or sometimes there is clarity, but it's clarity in silos. So you might have a sales team that's trying to hit a sales target. You might have an operational team who need to ensure that everything is working. And so you've got these different, but they haven't been, those targets haven't been pulled together in a cohesive way. They've been developed separately by the leadership of those different silos. So we normally find it relatively easy to manage down, right? We find it relatively easy to tell people in our teams what we'd like them to do, at least one would hope. Mm-hmm. It's much harder to manage up, but this problem requires upward management, and it's about, and there's a way in which you should do that, and it's not, are you guys all doing it wrong up there? It's actually, can you build really good collaborative relationships with your, you know, with your fellow leaders, with your peers, across those what might be silos, to come together with some clear why. So I'm a big Simon Sinek fan, and Simon Sinek says, start with why. It's what we call the golden circle. So all of those people are starting with often the how or the what. Sell more stuff, make more stuff work, whatever it might be. But often that is not tied together to a unified kind of why. So, and I think in older legacy organizations, there's far more focus on the how and the what. And in the museum sector, often the what was a building with stuff in. Now, I've made that sound terrible. Actually, there are some fabulous buildings with some incredible stuff in. what it's really doing is making history come alive. You can sometimes touch and see and smell. I'm at IWM Duxford today, which is a museum and an air working airfield, so you can literally, like, these are working planes, working Spitfire, so you can smell them and you can see them and you can hear them, so that's incredible, like, tangible stuff. And that's why I think we're quite focused on the how and the what, because the what is so incredible, right? And the how is get people to IWM Duxford to see these incredible machines and to learn about them, and more importantly, learn about the people who flew them and the people affected by them. But the why is actually much more about communicating a better understanding of conflict. And so we need to take these people on a journey from coming here to see an amazing Spitfire to understanding the Spitfire, understanding what it might have been like to be in a Spitfire, understanding what it might have been like to be a pilot shooting someone down, a pilot who's been shot down, what it might feel like to be the enemy, you know, and exploring conflict in more detail. And so that's our why. And getting everyone in our organization aligned behind that is the critical thing. And I think for me also, a lot of people say they work at museums, but when you work for another organization, often you say, I work for this organization. And I think often there's a real, like, purpose behind that. And so as a sector, and I think certainly at IWM, we're really keen for our staff to work for IWM, because it's a really good organization to work for, because there's a really good reason to work for us, and it's about communicating that better understanding. So the why is really important. It's not just about alignment, it's also about getting people really passionate about why we're aligned and why we're all working for the same thing and all going in the same direction. And so So that relationship building is really important. It's really important to have the confidence, to build the confidence, to manage up. Managing up is just actually inspiring your leadership by coming to them with good ideas. And the best way to come to them with good ideas is to come along with your colleagues and say, look how joined up we are. And they will want that. So I think it's really important that, you know, you work towards those kinds of relationships.
No, that's a really interesting point. It was probably leading me on to imagine for a listener here who is in a startup type business, for example, you know, different to IWM, and they're at a stage where maybe they're defining their why. You know, they may have had an idea that's a proof of concept, if you like, within the tech world, and they have their what. But yeah, they need to go out and find the why. Do you believe that, say, everyone in that business has to be involved in formulating the why, or is that a management thing who's taken inspiration from those guys? How do you think that should work?
Startups are great, really good example. And startups are kind of equally terrifying and liberating at the same time. I would say that, yeah, you really should start with your why. You should start with why before you start developing your app, before you hire an engineer, probably. It is my advice, but it's never too late. Yes, it should involve everyone. To underline that point, it's about getting people really passionate about what you do. I used to work for Google, and Google's why is to organize the world's information and make it available to everyone. And you know, Google was a startup once, and I think, you know, often these things become harder the larger you become. But I really like that as a why, and I think it's something that, you know, every member of staff should be able to get behind. It gets more as you become this giant juggernaut. I think there are some aspects that become a lot more nuanced. But if you look at a lot of the big kind of unicorns and things, they will all have a good why, and I think it's really important. It's not just about inspiring your staff; it's your strategic lens. It's a lens through which all of your strategy goes, is looked through, and starts from. And also, it should be a why that puts you in the position of your customers. And so, if I was a customer, would I be behind this? Because that's where your authenticity as a brand also comes from. Mm-hmm. So if you're a startup, you can see how important it is in every aspect of what you do. So I would definitely say, yep, get everyone involved in understanding it. Get your customers involved, not just your staff, would be another piece of advice I would recommend as well.
Of course. And I suppose, sticking with the startup analogy for a minute or two, do you think the why can change during the evolution of a business? Because if you use Google as the example you just gave, it that would almost be an audacious goal for a startup. And although, you know, let's say they did achieve that or very much on the way to doing so, I suppose sometimes when you're trying to grow a business, could you ever inspire new hires to actually believe that's achievable when you're a 20-man business opposed to a couple of hundred thousand? You know, should that why ever change, or is it stick to it and go?
Right, so it should be aspirational. Mm-hmm. And there's different views as to whether you should target something. If you're in an organization, say a cancer research organization, you're essentially trying to cure a cancer, I would say go ahead and put an endpoint in it, right? We want to cure this cancer, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we want to cure brain tumors. I think have that as your why. Now that is hard, right? Really, really hard, but it is possible. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a good why. Sometimes your why, you know, can and should seem impossible, and that's okay. And the reason that's okay, sorry, I'm going to channel Simon Sinek again, and his one of his other books, which is the Infinite Game. So this is like game theory, okay? And the problem is that, you know, a football match or a game of chess is finite, okay? There are known players, known rules. Okay, well, we know when we finished, we know what the end looks like. But business, and often like charity, and nonprofits are in an infinite game. And so your why needs to reflect that. So the example Simon Sinek always gives is Microsoft and Apple.
Yeah.
So Microsoft spent years under Steve Ballmer trying to develop a mobile device that would compete with the iPhone, trying to hire the best mobile developers, the best engineers, and often trying to poach them from the likes of Apple to try to create Microsoft's version of the iPhone. Why? It was to beat Apple, to beat the competition. But Apple was in the infinite game. So Apple didn't really care about Microsoft. They weren't trying to win or have the best phone by a given time or by a given date. They just wanted to, they knew essentially that if they just continually met customers' needs and answered customers' needs and developed their product for their customers, that they would continue to generate revenue. And actually that's the infinite game. And that's players who understand the infinite game. And if you're in an organization which is trying to beat the competition or become number one, the problem is that you might become number one, but for how long? For a month, 2 months, 10 years, 100 years, 1,000 years? It's an infinite game. So why not just focus on what you do, focus on the why, and then you're always doing the best you can. Another thing is to kind of focus much more on momentum rather than finite goals. So short-termism is really unhealthy, and short-termism often involves you pulling out all the stops or making compromises in one quarter or 1 year in order to meet an arbitrary number, which then potentially damages you much further along the line. Momentum is much more important. Momentum is just, is the number going up? Are we going in the right direction? And the things that we do that result in going up more quickly, we do more of. The things that result in us going down or going up less quickly, we do less of. So momentum is much more important at managing your teams. Momentum is far more important than giving them specific goals. So that's what I think. So it's a long-winded way of answering your question, but I think there's a lot of context that belongs with it, which is your why really should be aspirational. It's because almost all of us are in the infinite game. Some of us are trying to cure cancer. That is finite, but it's very long-term.
Of course. And I suppose on the context of the infinite game, if you like, if you look at a business who potentially lost that, and I think it's a bit of a classical analogy within digital transformation is the whole Blockbuster versus Netflix trade-off, if you like. And obviously Netflix seemed to have come off on top in the sphere of video on demand, if you like. Was it the case that Blockbuster's why was wrong, or did they just react badly? Or, you know, what's your thoughts on why that occurred, I suppose?
So this goes back, I think, I talked about the exponential age, and I think technology has been exponentially growing since basically, the 60s and 70s. Okay, so, but it compounds. Okay, so I often use the grain of rice analogy. Are you familiar with this one?
I'm not, no, actually.
If you put you've got a chessboard. Chessboard's got 64 squares. If you put a grain of rice on the first square, and then you double that and put two grains of rice on the second square, and you double that and put four grains of rice on the third square, and you continue until the 64th square, you end up with something like 16 quintillion grains of rice by the 64th square.
Right.
And that's exponentiality, right? And you can't imagine that number. You can't imagine that many. It's impossible for us to do as humans. Like we're just not built to do it. Mm-hmm. So exponentiality is compound growth. And we're in an era of technological compound growth. So it's going really quickly. So what happened with Blockbuster is they went VHS, and that existed for a while, and then DVDs, and that existed for a shorter amount of time, and then Blu-ray, which existed for a much shorter period of time, and then streaming. Okay, and so that's the grains of rice. That's the exponentiality, and you can see how that's like ramping up really quickly. They built an organization with tens of thousands of physical stalls and leases, and then the exponential curve hit the kind of the point like of no return arrived, and they're in this position where they're going to find it impossible to keep pace because it no longer requires tens of thousands of stores. So they tried to mitigate this in two ways. The first way was in 2001, they recognized so this is interesting because they clearly understood that some aspect of this exponentiality and the technology was definitely going to change, and they saw that. Most of us still had, in like the noughties, a lot of us still had like dial-up modems, and or the ADSL lines we had were 512 kilobits, maybe a megabyte, depending on a megabit, depending on where you were in the world. Not many people had that. And compression codecs for streaming were nowhere near as efficient as they are today. So we couldn't compress the video anywhere near as much. So they saw this coming, and they partnered with a company called Enron, who you might have heard of. And Enron, it turned out, were not the company they thought they were. They did invest some money in this project. It didn't go well. It turned out that they wanted to stream video to 500 homes. The 500 homes didn't have a good enough internet connection. They laid cable to the 500 homes. It cost an absolute fortune, and they made no money. Blockbuster bailed pretty much at the same time as Enron were getting into trouble for their dodgy accountancy practices. So they abandoned that project. The Netflix was still actually sending DVDs in the post at this time. Netflix offered themselves up to Blockbuster. Blockbuster declined because they had their fingers burnt with the last streaming project. And then within about a year and a half, the kind of, it became apparent what their strategy should have been. Netflix no longer wanted to put themselves up for sale. They were perfectly happy with their strategy, and Blockbuster had nowhere to go. So that's like potted history. So Blockbuster understood. They tried to do something early, I think because they were trying to play the finite game, right? They were trying to get in there as early as possible. Turns out they went in too early, earlier than Netflix. So when Netflix timed their entry much better, I think because they had the patience to just wait until the compression technology improved and people's bandwidth increased, and there was an optimal time to enter that market, whereas there was a sort of touch of desperation with Blockbuster. So I think there are lessons to be learned there, although it's hard to think that, I don't know if I'd have made different decisions if I was Blockbuster, and like we look at all of this with 2020 hindsight, and I think we need to bear that in mind. But the exponential age is still going, right? The world of blockchain is arriving, and blockchain enables things called DAOs, which are decentralized autonomous organizations, that are particularly good at replacing things like Uber and Kickstarter and Airbnb and potentially social networks. So these organizations that we consider to be disruptors are potentially about to get disrupted themselves. And I don't know how they're going to treat that either. So the most important thing is to understand your customers and the landscape, what's happening to them, maintain that understanding as much as you can, and encourage your staff and your leadership to understand that the world is changing really quickly. In that world, you need to create more autonomy in your organization because you have to be able to react quickly, and deeply centralized organizations don't react quickly, but more autonomous, test and learn, momentum-based organizations are much more likely to be able to understand what's happening and mitigate that and come up with new products and services that might work in that world. So the other thing is, blockchain is the world of the young, younger than me, and I like to think I'm young, but I'm definitely not. So again, providing much more autonomy and leveraging the skills and experience of younger people in your organization that might understand some of these emerging technologies better, again, is also going to be really important.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting one with blockchain, isn't it? As you said, because it's an emerging technology, we're entering a dangerous area where a 16-year-old in their bedroom might be more set up to deal with blockchain than a business who we now deem to be successful, if you like, you know, like an Uber, for example. And, you know, someone could come out of nowhere and become a competitor to them simply because they understand the landscape and the future better. And I suppose probably leads me to a final question then. How do you think the best way is for a business to try and see around corners for these emerging trends? Because you've talked about knowing your customer base, for example. You know, is that the main source of information in your opinion, or is it bigger than that?
It is bigger than that, because you should absolutely get to know your customers, your current customers, but you also need to understand the wider landscape and understand where other opportunities might be. So it isn't just about that. You talked about 16-year-olds who understand blockchain more than we do sitting in their bedrooms. I mean, one piece of advice is to hire them. this is where experimentation and testing and learning comes in. Sometimes you can understand the opportunity, you understand the market size, you can allocate some capital to it, and you can build a project to meet that need. And that's a more traditional way of going about it. Other times, you just need to create kind of skunk works, kind of labs, or, you know, what that is in reality is working like groups of people within your organization who you give them capacity and time to experiment and try new things, and say to them, look at blockchain, look at what's happening with our customers at blockchain, what could happen with our customers with regards to blockchain, look at what everyone else is doing on blockchain and come up with some ideas. And there are loads of mechanisms you can use for testing and learning. And I'm a big fan of the 5-day design sprints, which is like a really good kind of innovation technique where you can pull together a group of people. Often you would have subject matter experts or like people who know your customers really well, combine them with UX people, a developer or engineer, and various other people who a designer, people who might you think could contribute to a project, and have them give them 5 days to come up with a prototype, just a working prototype of some concept or some idea. And that you have to take them out of your normal operation for 5 days, but it's definitely worth it. It was worth doing that, building capacity in, to do that on a regular basis, because it gives you this ability to test and learn and come up with new ideas. And these prototypes, they might not nail it, but they get you thinking about other things and refining ideas. It's also just a really fun thing for a lot of your teams to work on. It gives them some time out. So it's really good to make sure that that's not always the same group of people, that you're spreading that out and giving other people opportunity to contribute, which then gives you the benefit of the knowledge in your wider teams as well. So yeah, we definitely need to look outside of just our current customer base. And sometimes if you're going to reach an entirely new audience, you need to create an entirely new concept or entirely new thing to do that.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's a really interesting point you make, actually, because I think as two individuals who work within the technology sector, I think there's a lot of businesses who will set, say, 5 hours a week outside a developer's normal working activities for personal development, let's say. And I suppose for what reason, you know, that could be used for that sort of activity every, you know, once a month, for example, and, you know, could definitely help those businesses. But you know, I suppose hindsight's a lovely thing, and you know, we'll sort of see how people come out the back of that. But look, Nick, I'd say thank you for the session. I think I've learned a great deal. I've learned that I need to read some Simon Sinek books, and learned a lot about the evolution of Blockbuster and Netflix as well. But I suppose thank you for your time, and hope listeners did enjoy and learn something too.
That was great, Chris. An absolute pleasure. Yeah, really fun talking to you.
Perfect. Thank you. Thank you, Nick, and for everyone listening. I hope you found the session interesting. Please stay tuned for future Godel pods.